In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual variety of natural attractions.
The towering mountains, the modern, friendly city, the innumerable rivers and lakes.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell now joins us for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And this week, for the new year, two scenic viewpoints of Seattle, one old and one new, Felix.
You know, it's a cliche, but we really do live in a very beautiful city. Hopefully nobody's listening from out of town and wants to move here because there's already plenty of people here. But I was at one of my favorite scenic view overlooks the other day, and then I stumbled across a brand new city park that's under construction and not even open yet. So since it's the new year, I wanted to highlight something old and something new. The first is the Louisa Boren Denny Lookout on Capitol Hill. This is off of 15th Avenue, just northeast of Volunteer Park and across the street from the Lakeview Cemetery. It has views of Lake Washington and the Cascades that are breathtaking. You can see Mount Baker on a clear day. You can also see the UW campus, 520 Bridge, Portage Bay. I mean, I was out there a few days ago. The sun was out. It was gorgeous. It's named for Louisa Boren Denny. She arrived in Seattle on November 13, 1851, when she was just Louisa Boren. She married David Denny, also a member of that Pioneer Party. And those two are considered one of the first, if not the very first, settler couple to be married in Seattle in 1853. Mm-hmm. So. Now, what I didn't know until I did some research is that Louisa Boren Denny was 86 years old and was actually on hand in June 1914 when the park was dedicated in her name. They had a big ceremony there, hundreds of people. She didn't speak, but she was there the whole time, and she arrived by car, and she was watching and listened attentively. You know, they told her life story. And so she was actually there when that park was dedicated in her name, which is pretty cool. And she passed away 2 years later. The park historian Don Sherwood wrote of her, "She spent much time trying to beautify the town, but she also typified the rugged pioneer spirit, made her own moccasins, shot game, chopped wood, and raised 8 children while she was feeding horses, milking cows, and trading with the Indians."
Felix, I kid you not, before you came in here, I was hoping that would be the viewpoint that you were going to mention.
Excellent.
Because I spent a lot of my time in high school up on Capitol Hill, actually.
Smoking clove cigarettes.
yes, clove. No. There's a very cool sculpture there too, right at that park.
Yeah, it's from the mid 1970s. I can't remember the name of the artist who did the sculpture, but Victor Steinbrück, the famous landscape architect, did the layout for that park. It's a great place to take people from.
Such a beautiful view.
Yeah. Now the second viewpoint, it's in the so new it's not even open to the public yet. It's called Portage Bay Park. It's along the north side of Portage Bay on the south edge of the UW campus. This is along Boat Street. It's the former site of the UW police station and the surplus sales area. It used to be this kind of gritty industrial thing. The city purchased the land with 520 mitigation funds. It's been under construction for the past several months and opens sometime later this year. And already, though, from outside the fence, you can get a sense of how amazing this park will be. It's right along the water. You get views of Capitol Hill, the Ship Canal Bridge, University Drawbridge, all kinds of cool boat traffic going by. Now, Portage Bay Park is only one name for this new park. Here's what the Seattle Parks and Recreation Department website says. The new park in Portage Bay will be named Fritz Hedges Waterway Park. Frederick Fritz Hedges was a long-term Seattle Parks and Recreation professional, last serving as the Director of Policy, Planning, and Evaluation. Fritz dedicated his life to the idea that parks and recreation are vital components of urban life for all residents. So, not sure which name will catch on the most, but I reached out to the Parks Department over the weekend, wasn't able to hear back from them before the holiday. So, anyway, either one's a great place to take out-of-town guests or just go by yourself and be reminded of how wonderful where we live is.
I like the Fritz name because you can just say the Fritz Bridge.
See it, the Fritz.
See it, yeah. The Fritz.
I'll be on the Fritz.
It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, it might catch on if we work on it right here on Seattle's Morning News.
Our top story again this hour comes to us from Iraq, where a U.S. drone strike has killed a top Iranian general. Let's get caught up now on how we got to this point. We called up Face the Nation host and CBS senior foreign affairs correspondent Margaret Brennan.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is saying this morning that there was an active plot against the U.S. and Americans. But what that is, whether that threat is gone, what he meant by that, whether that was U.S. soil or foreign soil, is not clear. It has not been explained yet. We have to believe those details are forthcoming because this was a targeted assassination of one of Iran's top leaders, someone the U.S. considered a terrorist, but so close to the leader of Iran that this could be interpreted as an act of war.
Any interpretation of the timing of this assassination? Because, you know, while these rumors of imminent threats to American lives may as well be true, you know, they also say he's already responsible for hundreds of deaths to American service members. So why now?
Exactly. Great question. Look, Qasem Soleimani is not going to be mourned by any Democrat, by any Republican. He was an enemy of the United States. He has the blood on his hands of at least 600 U.S. service members since the Iraq War and thousands of people throughout the Middle East. But past U.S. presidents have stopped short of assassinating him because it is an act of war, because it could quickly escalate. This is not just a terrorist. This is someone who was so close to the supreme leader of Iran, who by taking off the battlefield could trigger a domino effect. And that is why this morning you have national security officials, many of them very silent in terms of being able to explain what happens next. A lot of concern in the region about potential risks to not just to U.S. interests, but to U.S. allies, and also concerns that Iran may decide to scrap what remains of that diplomatic deal and restart its nuclear program.
Well, and you mentioned the word war. I was struck this morning logging onto social media, the number of young people talking about the draft. Parents, I'm sure, worried about another war in the Middle East. So, you know, it feels like we've been talking about war with Iran for a decade or more. What's likely to happen now?
Well, that is true. And if you recall, the Obama administration believed that there was the brink, we were on the brink of war, and that Israel might carry out a preemptive strike. That was part of the calculation years ago for President Obama to try these back channel secret talks that ended up resulting in this diplomatic deal with the world powers and Iran. We've been to the brink before, but no U.S. president has ever in recent history made the decision to assassinate one of Iran's top leaders. This is like taking out the vice president or the CIA director. You can imagine what the U.S. government would be thinking if that happened. This is a serious escalation. Make no mistake. Qasem Soleimani is an American enemy. He's been plotting attacks against Americans for many years. But this is something that we need to know what happens next. Where does this story end up? We haven't heard it yet.
What can Iran do to retaliate against America?
Qasem Soleimani was basically the commander of Iran's forays abroad. If it's intervention in Syria to bolster a murderous regime there, or backing militias who were attacking U.S. troops in Iraq, meddling in Lebanon, basically the entire Middle East was Qasem Soleimani's portfolio. There is concern, as you're seeing from mayors in the United States, that there could be blowback on U.S. soil. It is very easy to go to worst case scenarios. It is very easy to be hyperbolic about this. But, you know, there's a range of different things, from cyber attacks to terror attacks to restarting its nuclear program to carrying out some kind of action against Israel, against Jordan, against the American allied countries in the Middle East. Iran's oil flow, not just from its own country, but the waterways around it. Iran has a lot of different levers. And even though it's on the ropes economically, even though it's being financially strangled, even though it's under piles and piles of U.S. sanctions, none of the Trump administration's efforts have stopped Iran's escalations and attacks. It is not clear if assassinating the man directing those attacks will stop them now.
It's Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. And just moments ago, we heard from the president via Twitter. Reading quotes here, the United States has paid Iraq billions of dollars a year for many years. That is on top of all else we have done for them. The people of Iraq do not want to be dominated and controlled by Iran, but ultimately that is their choice. Over the last 15 years, Iran has gained more and more control over Iraq, and the people there are not happy with that. It will never end well. Those are the president's words just minutes ago. This is Seattle's Morning News, and why have a single Friday film review when you can have 10? Cairo critic Tom Dagny's top 10 of 2019. Tom, you're here now. I've been looking at your list. I've seen, I think, like three or four of these.
I've heard of two.
That's pretty good. Good for you guys. Yeah.
Try.
Well, in fact, I want to, in order to make this live instead of just kind of running on, if you guys have seen any of these movies, okay. I want to weigh in. Let's see if we can get a discussion going.
Okay.
And so for my number 10, we'll go in reverse order.
Okay.
Aaron, see, it makes it more dramatic. So
absolutely.
We're building up
yeah.
to number one. Yeah. That's how it works. So, and the reason I wanted to start with number 10 is because it's one of the few movies that maybe most of us have seen, if, you know, not just heard, and that is Toy Story 4.
No,
now,
sorry, I've not seen it.
Well, yeah. You're the one with the kid
I know,
and all
I
that.
Child.
I know, you're
I
one.
Never
literally.
Saw past one.
Is that right?
I've well, seen,
and
I've
had
seen
a kid
one
growing
three.
Up.
Okay, one
I
through
have
three.
Seen
okay.
one through three, and I loved one through
absolutely.
Three.
Absolutely. Well, and this is, so my take on Toy Story 4 is this is an absolutely unnecessary sequel to the greatest animated trilogy of films ever, and yet This Pixar gem proves to be every bit their equal.
Okay.
This time out, the cowboy string puppet Woody faces the existential question of all toys and, by extension, all of us, of course, Aaron.
Yes.
What value do we have when we're no longer wanted or needed? Like all the Toy Story movies, Toy Story 4 is more about the adults than the kids.
That is some deep stuff from some toys.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's the great thing about Pixar has made animation deep dives into anything and everything about a human experience.
Yeah.
My ninth favorite movie of the year is The Lighthouse, which is not a movie that a lot of people have seen. I don't expect them to see it. It's what I would just recommend it. By the way, we're posting my entire top 10 list if you want to really figure out more about it. This is a black and white movie that stars William Dafoe and Robert Pattinson as two guys stuck on working a lighthouse on an island during a storm, and it's very kind of mythic and poetic and all of that. It's not your general kind of
two great actors, though.
Yeah, two great actors with a great script and great visuals. Number eight, people might have heard of. I don't know if any of them have managed to make it through the entire way, but my number eight film for the year is The Irishman, and I call this a quiet epic. It's directed by Martin Scorsese. It's kind of like a career capper of his string of mob movies. You've probably heard a lot about it. It's got De Niro. It's got Pacino. It's got Joe Pesci. It's 3.5 hours sit, but it's a Netflix movie, which means you can go home tonight and sit through it if you want to. It's a masterful kind of philosophical take on mobster movies. Not a lot of
Sully
action.
Sully has got a hot take.
Yes,
it was awful.
So
absolutely, I told you it was the worst movie since Contact.
Over the holidays, so we're both on vacation, I get a text. You know, I have a lot of movie buddies I talk to all the time. And I rarely hear from Chris because he's catching up with 1989 movies and 1990 movies. Uh-huh. And I hear from Chris about The Irishman, and he hated it. And I've got to say, your biggest objection was?
It's a story that we already knew. That it was promised like, ooh, what really happened to Jimmy Hyde? And then, so basically it seemed to me like a knockoff of Casino, Goodfellas, and, just what it is. You know, so it's
that's
just
right,
like,
Mean Streets to complete
kind of a
his
combo.
Trilogy.
I didn't learn anything. Now, granted, the acting was great at times, but I mean, for a movie that didn't go anywhere, for a story I already knew, it was like, ugh,
and
what a drone.
And that's why Titanic never made a dime. We already knew what was going to happen.
Right.
And by the way, the suggestion here is this is the guy, the Irishman is the guy behind the murder of Jimmy Hoffa. But we don't even know that. He confessed to it, but a lot of people say, oh, that's BS. We don't even believe that. So this is just one man's take on it. But I think the biggest objection that people might have for 3.5 hours, and again, you can stop it. If it's on your TV set, you can stop, go get a Coke or a
I read
coffee
something where
drink.
You can split it up in like a 4-part miniseries.
Yes. No, I mean, I think that's exactly right. 3.5 hour movie. You don't need. I saw it all in one sitting in a movie theater.
Me too.
And it worked.
Not in a theater.
And it worked fine. But still, I think the biggest problem people have is they expect a kind of an action movie. There's nothing flashy about it. But Scorsese says he shot the movie the way his lead character was, which is he's basically a guy in the background who doesn't want to draw attention so he can do his hits. Anyway, it's a quiet epic, and it wasn't loud enough for Chris.
And again, I'm not the audience. I'm sure it's going for.
I think you are.
I gave it a go.
You're an Irishman.
True. I gave it a go, but I was like, oh, put me to sleep.
Okay, so we got number seven is a movie called Us.
I have seen this.
This you have.
I have
okay.
seen Us.
So this, his breakout film, Get Out, was unbelievably popular. This now, I think it's an even more ambitious take on what he's trying to do. He's rather than kind of blaming one group of people for another group of people's misery, in this, I think he implicates all of us in our nation's problems. I think it has clear parallels with another movie that we'll get to later in the year. Did you want to weigh in? Did you like Us?
I thought it was better than Get Out as well. Yeah.
Wow,
you want to talk about existential. That I mean, Us is that movie.
Yeah, it's all inclusive. Yeah. There's no escaping. We're all culpable. Okay, number six, you probably have heard of, even if you haven't seen it, it's called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That's Quentin Tarantino's A Valentine to the Hollywood of His Youth. It's really, what I think is interesting about that is that it's a really complicated crossover collision between TV cowboys of the 50s, jet-setting celebrities, and hippie dropouts, and only a crazy guy like Tarantino would dream of trying all those cultural strands together, and only a visionary director like Tarantino could pull it off with this fairy tale ending of violent proportions. I highly recommend that. Number five. Okay, we've got a couple of minutes here. Number five. This might be my most controversial. This is a very polarizing film. I'm putting Joker up as one of the top 10 movies of the year. The reason is I think Joaquin Phoenix might be our greatest actor. He's certainly one of our greatest actors. And he's playing probably the greatest comic book villain of all time. Yeah. Now, this movie has really gotten attacked because it's really over the top. It's excessively violent in a kind of artsy way, not in any kind of explicit way. But I really found it just so striking. I think his performance is so mesmerizing that it justifies all the kind of excess that
he's getting Oscar buzz for this.
And I think his strut dancing on top of a New York stairway is going to be a visual for the ages. They're going to be referring to that in decades from now.
Yeah.
Number four, Little Women. I love about this Little Women version, it's not this kind of musty 19th century family novel. Greta Gerwig has kind of come up with a really ingenious new approach to this 19th century material. She breaks up the chronology of the narrative, which gives it a kind of energy that you might not expect from this kind of novel. But she also blends Jo Marsh, the lead character in it, with the actual author, Louisa May Alcott. Fuses those two, really gives you an interesting take on it. I highly recommend Little Women. Number three is Marriage Story.
Just watched it last night.
Oh, you did? Oh, yeah. What did you think?
I thought it was great.
Yeah, it's
very real.
Yes. Oh my God, it is
raw.
It is. It tears your heart out. What's interesting about this? His description. Noah Baumbach wrote this about his own divorce. He was married to Jennifer Jason Leigh, and so it's about his divorce. And he says, I want to write a love story through the lens of divorce. And I think that's a fascinating way to take it. And I think he deserves major credit because when you watch the movie, it's really balanced. Can you imagine if you've gone through this hellacious divorce, how you would love to, score points against your ex-wife, for instance? Instead, it's really balanced. You see both sides. You understand why this happened, and it rips you apart.
Yeah.
That's great. And that's, again, Netflix. So you can go home and watch it tonight if you want.
Yeah.
Parasite is my number two film of the year. It's a Cannes Film Festival winner. It's a South Korean film. It's a really clever satire about the haves and the have-nots that gradually darkens and deepens into, as I put it, something of a sociological horror show. The parasite metaphor extends far beyond, I think, the Korean setting. It has a kind of universal relevance and resonance. It's a foreign film, but I think the power of the film, if you have any problem with subtitles, is easily overwhelmed by the power of the story. And then finally, my number one.
Number one.
This is a movie that opened on Christmas Day, and it's the least Christmassy kind of movie that you can imagine. It's called Uncut Gems. Wow. Now, there's this brother team. They're a New York brother team. Josh and Benny Safdie, they've created this brilliant, frenzied, nerve-wracking film about a high-stakes Manhattan gem dealer and an inveterate sports gambler, by the way, who lives life on the frantic edge. By setting the story very specifically in 2012, the script can play off real historical sporting events as it charts the gambler's ups and downs in seeming real time. The film's overpowering immediacy makes the audiences walk out of that theater frazzled and exhilarated. And this is the trick. If you haven't heard anything about this movie, Adam Sandler stars in this thing, and he is at his manic best. And yes, that Adam Sandler. This is an unbelievably powerful movie. It is not something that a lot of people can make it through. I saw it when my daughter, who's a film buff, 15 minutes in the movie, I looked over at her and said, is this whole movie going to be this frenetic? And it was, and it is. It keeps up the energy. It's like unlike anything you're going to see all year.
And Adam Sandler getting some Oscar buzz, too.
Absolutely.
Well. All right, Tom Sandy, thank you so much. His top 10 list, you can find that at MyNorthwest.com.
It's time now for your daily dose of kindness, sponsored now by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. An Atlanta woman's college dreams came true thanks to one Uber ride she'll never forget. LaTanya Young is a hairstylist by day, an Uber driver by night. During one particular trip, she got to talking with the passenger, ended up sharing more than usual. The 43-year-old single mom says she had to drop out of high school at the age of 16 to raise her first child. Then again and again, she tried to attend college, but eventually had to drop out for good. All because of a $700 unpaid balance at Georgia State University.
Every time I got ready to pay the money, my kids needed something. It was something going on where, I was like, okay, well, I'll just wait.
And a few days after that ride share, WIS-TV reports she got a phone call from the school.
And the message stated, okay, you're all set. You can register for classes now. And I was like, literally, I was blown away because a stranger has never done that or done anything like that for me.
So she says she went on with her education.
When he paid the balance, it was like I had to do this for him. I maintained my grades, A's and B's, just trying to do everything to make sure he know that I appreciated him.
And the update from WIS just recently, that Uber passenger, Kevin Esch, attended her graduation from Georgia State.
All right. Thank you, Colleen. 7:47, time now for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle. Stacey Ross, you can hear her weekdays at noon on Tom, Jake, and Stacey. It is a wild card Blue Friday. Seahawks on their way to Philadelphia to play the Eagles. Stacey, the Eagles won the Super Bowl just a couple seasons ago, but this is not the same Super Bowl caliber team, right?
Well, they have a lot of the same talent there. So, for instance, Carson Wentz, still fantastic. One of the best quarterbacks outside of the pocket. They have great receivers, good running back. Their O-line, which is down just potentially one guy this week, is the number one offensive line in the league, according to Pro Football Focus. Every single guy ranked in the top two at his position, with the exception of, I think, their left guard. The problem is a lot of those guys have been injured this year. So they've been really hampered by injuries, actually, the last 2 years. This year was even worse. So they're a team that has a lot of potential, a high ceiling. They should be competitive. They just have not been able to stay out of that blue medical tent on the sideline.
Seahawks can pretty much say the same thing, too. So how do we stack up? How do we compare in terms of injuries and matchups? What are we looking at here?
You know, it's a pretty good matchup, I think. The Seahawks, it's really going to happen up front. Seahawks defensive line is going to need to disrupt Carson Wentz. It doesn't seem like it, but this is actually his first postseason appearance, because if you guys will remember, he was knocked out of the season during Philly's Super Bowl run and Super Bowl win. Nick Foles was kind of the postseason hero for that team because Carson Wentz was knocked out of the year with an ACL and I think MCL injury. So this is going to be his very first playoff game. So Doug Peterson, the Eagles head coach, is really focused on keeping it up tempo. Tim McManus has this really great article on ESPN about kind of their plan on offense to make Carson Wentz comfortable. So the Seahawks defense, which has been up and down, has a chance to go against essentially a really young, inexperienced quarterback in the playoffs, at least. So that matches up pretty well. Problem is, you actually need to do it. If he gets comfortable, Carson Wentz can be pretty deadly.
I'm still sitting pretty, having watched Skittles back on the field with the Seahawks. I'm just curious, is Marshawn going to play a part in this game as well?
Yes, I would expect his role to increase a little bit. It's still going to be Travis Homer starting. Homer's still going to get the bulk of the reps. But I wouldn't be shocked to see Marshawn Lynch get even more carries than he had last week.
And you've kept it pretty real as far as your expectations for a win or a loss with the Seahawks. I think a lot of the times, we have a tendency to say, yeah, Seahawks are going to win. Of course they're going to win. This is our team. But you keep it real and you're like, actually, I'm not feeling this game. So what about this one coming up? It sounds like it's going to be a win for the Seahawks based on past performance, but I want to hear it from you, Stacey.
Yeah, I am expecting a Seahawks win today. When we do our kind of Friday afternoon kind of preview later today, I'm going to be predicting a Seahawks win, as I'm sure my co-hosts will. I think the big key for Seattle is going to be not looking past Philadelphia, because they are favored even on the road against Philadelphia. But Philadelphia, if you get them, like I said, if you get them comfortable, if they get going, those injuries aren't going to mean much of anything, because the practice squad guys that have been filling in are pretty good. They've been pretty decent. And most importantly, the offensive line and their safeties and their defensive front has still been solid. So even with that, I'm predicting a Seahawks win.
Seems like every successful postseason run has somebody that steps up that maybe you never heard of before or didn't think would step up. Who got your eye on who's maybe not, number three, for instance?
I think it would be big for the receivers in this one. I know that last time these two teams met, running back Rashad Penny had his best game as a pro. I'm not expecting the most productive day for the running backs, not because Seattle doesn't still have good running backs, but because Philadelphia's defensive line has been one of the best teams against the run. So I think what you're looking for is, can someone like rookie DK Metcalf or wide receiver John Ursua, that'd be a good one. Can John Ursua come up with a big random catch? You know, he might only see, you know, two targets, but can you make the most of them?
Who else should we be rooting for or against in the other games this weekend?
I think you always want upsets. If you're a Seahawks fan, you're rooting for a team like Minnesota to beat the Saints. Do I think that's going to happen? Absolutely not. But that's what you, it's what you're rooting for, not just because you would get to, you know, eventually host a home game the lower the seeds won. But, I mean, the Saints are not a good matchup for you. I think Seattle has a better chance of beating the 49ers for a second time, you know, as opposed to like a week 10 and then the loss after that, than they do to beat the Saints. So I think you're probably rooting for Minnesota.
If Minnesota wins, does that mean we host Minnesota the following week?
I think it would depend how it all unfolded. Okay. I got to really take a look at it, but they are a lower seed than you. Mm-hmm. So if Minnesota, it would be this wacky world that you've never seen before, where the two wild cards were the ones that went on to the conference championship. In that case, you would host the Vikings, but I don't think that's ever happened.
Okay, we'll keep an eye out. All right, Cease, we didn't get your score prediction, by the way, for the Eagles game.
Ooh, okay. I'm going to say 28 Seattle, and let's go 21 Philadelphia.
Tight game. All right. Stacey Ross, you can hear weekdays at noon on Tom, Jake, and Stacey on 710 ESPN Seattle. Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, guys.
Should the HPV shots be added to Washington's list of required school vaccinations? This is a question on the agenda at next week's State Board of Health meeting that has some parents now sounding the alarm. Kiowa Radio's Hannah Scott is here with more, Hannah.
So, Aaron, this is coming less than a year after the state legislature took away the ability of parents to opt out of the mandatory MMR vaccines for personal and philosophical beliefs. And that sparked outrage, if you remember, at the legislature among those parents who are opposed to mandatory vaccines. A new this new vaccination requirement to require HPV vaccines to be given to students for school is on the agenda for the upcoming Board of Health meeting. But first, I must stress that this is a citizen petition is why this is on the agenda for the Board of Health. So someone in the state thinks this is a good idea. They petition this to the Board of Health, and they have the choice of whether or not to bring it up as a discussion. This will be a discussion about whether or not they want to proceed and actually discuss talking about this and start that process.
And I think we should clarify for people the difference between, say, something like a vaccine for MMR and something like HPV is a little bit more loaded because it is sexually transmitted.
It is absolutely more loaded. So the HPV is a virus that can lead to a variety of cancers, largely cervical cancers. It is an STD, though. It is transmitted through sexual activity. And starting in 2006, the CDC started to recommend this vaccine that is made by Merck. It's called Gardasil, and it can prevent, if you give it to kids, nine girls at the time, it was recommended for girls 9 to, I believe, 20 or so. If you give it to them early on before they're sexually active, it can prevent that cervical cancer from eventually happening to them.
And there are hundreds of strains of HPV,
yes,
but only about,
yes,
only about six that can cause these types of cancer. So what the Gardasil says it does is protects against those strains that cause the cancer.
Yes, and absolutely does. And they say over the last, however, since 2006, that the rate of HPV has dramatically been reduced. And they have also seen reductions in cancerous lesions tied to this because of the vaccination. So they've really dramatically expanded the recommendations over the last few years to who's supposed to get this. Now it's not just girls. Now it's all girls and boys in that age group. Then it was expanded again. They're going now to the FDA recommends up to 45 years old, both men and women, because it might help. We don't know, but it can't hurt.
To make this a requirement, now I'm hearing pushback, not just from people who are anti-vaccine, but I mean people who just don't even want their kids or young children learning about these types of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I spoke with Mark Malosha. He is a former state lawmaker who is now heads up the Washington Family Policy Center. It's a conservative group in the state, religious group. And he says, first of all, they're opposed to government mandating anything. But when we're talking about sexually active behavior that is linked to this. There's this belief, and some parents have this too. Is this going to suggest, you know, or is my child at 9 years old going to get this and then, you know, later on at 10, 12, be more promiscuous because she thinks she's protected? Things of that nature. Just the fact that it indicates that your child is going to be having some sort of sexual activity at some point down the line is a concern for other parents.
I mean, I think that was the argument, too, when it came to abstinence-only education, that, you know, if you just don't teach them about sex, they won't have it. But as we have found out, that's not the case. Kids will have sex when they decide to have sex. The parent needs to, at least the argument is, the parent needs to educate their child and protect them the best they can.
Well, and absolutely. And a big part of this... look, you get into a touchy situation when you're talking about mandating, because there are going to be those parents who have that belief, right? And they don't want this for their kids.
That because a state shouldn't be telling me when to protect my child against STDs.
It's a different thing.
It'd be like the state handing your child a condom.
Right. And that's exactly the difference here. But then at the same time, there are those in the medical community who say this is going to, it could create this kind of herd immunity thing, right? Where we could eradicate cervical cancer. We could maybe down the line. So they want to get as many people.
Is there that much evidence, though, that a vaccine like that can... Is that effective?
It's too soon to tell. I can tell you that it has, they say, dramatically. A recent study in The Lancet, I think, that just came out a few months ago, says that it dramatically lowered, I think, almost by half HPV infections. Infections, not the cancer, just the infection of HPV. And then the lesions, the cancerous lesions. But they don't have enough. There hasn't been enough time yet to see whether it dramatically reduces the cancer rate, but most in the medical community believe so. But parents say there's a lawsuit that was against Merck over this particular drug because of parents who said that led to some injuries and some deaths. That there are so many protections against the vaccine companies, the drug makers, that they cannot be held liable because of a law in Congress that was passed in the 80s. And then even in this court case, it was tossed out because they can't go directly after the drug maker. They have to do something else instead. And that ended up, the federal court had tossed it out because they didn't follow the rules.
So we're running out of time, but just quickly, I wanted to sum up, you know, the parents who are going to the state legislature to discuss the Board of Health, you know, what action are they trying to take?
So this meeting is on the 8th. That's next Wednesday at the Board of Health's location, the Department of Health's office, I should say, in Tumwater. And anyone who wants to write in, these parents are asking anyone to write into the Board of Health, any comments, any concerns you have about this not being mandated and them not taking this up and making it a rule, you can do that online by noon today, or you can go to that meeting, which is another thing they're asking folks to do and that they plan to do, and show up and speak in the public comment. They're also going to be having a rally as the legislative session gets underway on the 14th, I believe, is when they're going to do it on the steps of the Capitol and share their thoughts about it there.
Kiowa Radio's Hannah Scott, thank you.
Seattle's Morning News. I think it's a dilemma that a lot of people face. I'm told by my church that I should help the poor, but I cannot stand that decrepit RV that's parked on my block. What do I do? How do I handle this mentally? It's time to ask Allie. Allie Sokolow is a licensed mental health counselor, and this segment is brought to you by Pro Club, the Northwest Premier Center for Health and Wellness. I think this is a real dilemma. I've been corresponding with a couple of people about this who are, you know, of course, we're all caught up in this homelessness crisis in Seattle. And yeah, you go to church and Christ says help the poor, but then do you give $5 to everybody who asks for it?
That's a really good question. And there's multiple layers to this question, I think. So the first one is, what is your own belief system around that? Do you feel like you should give money to the poor? That would be where I would start with people. And then the second thing is, I think we get caught in this trap of, well, okay, so I am going to contribute, but what does that look like? Because you can't contribute to everybody probably. And so what's your budget? What's your limit? What would make you feel good giving?
So do I tell the last guy, I'm sorry, my budget does not have room for you, so better luck tomorrow?
So that's a good question, because if you're talking about just giving $5 to everybody you pass on the street, that's a difficult one. You might have some awkward conversations if they see you giving money all the way up and then they stop, right?
Sorry, I'm out.
So you might want to think about how you want to contribute your money. Maybe it's not
through an organization then.
Potentially, if that's what makes you feel comfortable. And sometimes, like, maybe it's about donating something else to the people that you see on the streets.
Okay, what about people who feel this guilt that you were told to help the poor, but at the same time, that doesn't mean I want them in my neighborhood.
That's right. So first I would ask, you know, what's your fear around having people in your neighborhood? Why don't you like that RV on the end of your street?
Because it reminds me where I could end up if I lost my job.
Okay, so it's scary for you.
Yeah.
So that's something that maybe you should address, either in counseling or sort of like a deep dive into yourself of like, why do you have that fear of losing your job?
Mm-hmm.
Would this be a big deal if you were guaranteed job security for life?
Yeah.
Right?
I'm trying to think. I think with some people, maybe not. I think it might, even if they don't feel that kind of insecurity, it's just an eyesore. And who knows who's living there? I mean, we've heard that when somebody is, or, well, we've heard, we fear, there's that word again.
Yeah.
We fear that if somebody is reduced to living in an RV, it's because they've done something bad.
And that's the problem, right? I think that that is sort of the stereotype of homelessness that's not necessarily true. People are in all different sorts of situations. There are a lot of mental health factors, of course, for people who live on the streets. And so it's not necessarily that these people did anything bad. So it's more about checking your own reasons for what your thing is about having this RV. Mm-hmm. If it's a fear because it reminds you every day that maybe you're going to lose your job and this is where you're going to end up, that's something to address with yourself. If it's because you're worried about your housing prices going down because there's an RV on the street, then you might potentially have to live in a different neighborhood, right?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean,
that's the only, so I've got to change.
I mean,
I can't ask the cops to remove him. I got to change.
If he is legally parked there or she, then they get to stay. And that's sort of the thing about counseling in general, right? Is we do have to change our view of what's going on.
Yeah. I do remember the one encounter I had with a guy in an RV, because I park in kind of a dicey area because I'm cheap. I want to park free. And so
sure.
I park where everybody else parks, right? And then they include some people in RVs. And one time I was going back to my car and, you know, the guy was just relaxing outside the RV, getting a breath of fresh air. And he said hi, and I said hi. And he said, you need to be careful about parking here because we've seen some car prowls go by. And that's why sometimes I sit here to watch the cars, because I know if somebody gets their car prowled, I'd be blamed for it. This is the guy in the RV telling me this.
Oh, my
right?
gosh.
And he says this, and I said, I certainly feel better about this guy in the RV, because, yeah. you know, for that little moment, I got to know him, and I didn't inquire as to his circumstances, but, you know, he seemed to be the watchdog, yeah.
That's the thing. It's like it all goes back to this concept of cognitive behavioral therapy. If we change our story, we will change how we feel about the situation. You got additional information that maybe somebody wouldn't get having an RV down at the end of their street.
Yeah. Assuming he was telling me the truth.
I mean, there's that,
there's
right?
a conspiracy theory there that maybe that's an excellent way to throw me off the trail.
That's right. That's right. That's why we have car insurance, too.
And there you go. The cure to that fear of the RV is car insurance.
That's right.
Allie Sokolow, licensed mental health counselor. Allie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.